My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, I'm Rokas Pichelaitis, founder of Contrarian Ventures, and I'm excited to host this series on the journey to net zero. Let's hear from my guest today.
Hi, Clay. Welcome to Coffin Fellows podcast. It's great to have you today, and thanks for taking the time to share your journey with the broader community.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so let's get on to it. I want you to walk through your background and tell you how you got to where you are now.
Sure. So I have a sort of an unconventional path to venture. My startup education was actually working for Barack Obama on his 2008 campaign. At that time, I was already pretty cynical about politics, to be honest. But being part of the small team with a big idea to change the world, that experience really broadened what I thought was possible in a big way. And so for the next decade, that's really what I did. I worked on the campaigns and eventually in the administration. You know, my big company education was in the halls of the West Wing, you know, learning to think at a systems level about all these really big problems that were crossing the president's desk and getting to read all the memos on every topic, you know, that goes in front of the president of the United States, getting to write a few too once in a while, but also experiencing, you know, what it's like to be in a really, really big organization. So, yep. not the typical path into VC, but it was really important in one particular respect, which is that working in government and in policy really enforces a special type of long-term thinking. People in politics, you know, do think about like media cycles and talking points, but the bulk of the work behind the scenes is not about cheap thrills. You really are constantly having to ask yourself, how does what I'm working on today, how does this affect someone's life 10 years from now? What are the incentives it creates? What are the unintended consequences of what we're producing? And in a lot of ways, that actually is great preparation for venture capital, which to do it well, I think, you know, is ultimately about asking a lot of those same questions. Is how does this, you know, can I put myself in the shoes of this small team of these founders and imagine what the world looks like in 10 years as their company grows? And what are the implications? How have they made people's lives better? And it forces you to, I think, avoid the sort of cheap thrills and trend chasing that, you know, sometimes is a feature of this industry in the same way that it can be a feature of politics, but ultimately the people who are successful at it. And I think the lesson, at least I took away from working in the Obama administration was to think at, you know, on those sort of 10-year horizons.
Now, this is amazing. So you spent over 7 years, right? Sort of in the White House or working in politics to a certain extent. And Obama was pretty big in climate, I think, at that point already addressing a lot of these issues that I think now obviously exacerbated to another level. What did you had any chance to work that back then on some of those issues?
Yeah, I got to intersect and touch on a lot of climate and energy issues, although it was never my sole focus. It's funny, before I got into politics, I had sort of been on a trajectory to work in climate and energy. Spent some time at one of the biggest solar panel manufacturers in the world when I was there, and a few years later it was filing for bankruptcy. So I had my own brush with sort of clean tech 1.0. But it's funny, I think when I was in government, my exposure to working on climate and sustainability and conservation was really shaped by, you know, the experience of doing it at a government level, which is massively impactful, but also is sort of pretty far removed from, you know, both the front lines of the science, but also the innovation that was taking place. And so when I left the White House, I knew that I wanted to, you know, ultimately end up in a role where I was focused on climate full time. But there was definitely kind of a relearning curve, not just like, hey, we got to go, you know, relearn some of the physics and chemistry that you haven't looked at in a long time and, you know, signing up for classes on Coursera, but also just like going really deep and, you know, subscribing to all the journals and getting to know academics and scientists and trying to understand, you know, not only, you know, like how has our understanding of climate science evolved over the last few years, but what's happening on the fringes, you know, what are the entrepreneurs and, you know, the entrepreneurial scientists that are thinking about how the, you know, what the world looks like in a decade, how has their thinking evolved, you know, in ways that maybe, you know, hadn't bubbled up to kind of the top of our government.
So 2017, you leave the White House and you partner up and join Chris Sacca at Lowercase Capital, right? At that time. So how did that transition happen? Firstly, it was not necessarily a direct season. There was already a portfolio of companies there that you probably jumped in when you joined. How does that transition work? And obviously, we're going to talk about Lower Carbon Capital that got guys launched later down the road. But maybe a few reflections on when you start, you know, in the venture and how did that reflect for you personally?
Sure. So I just want to take people back to who, and I'm sorry for trigger warning, but I want to take people back to those early months of 2017, which, you know, for me, having dedicated a decade of my life to working and helping to elect Barack Obama, the election of Donald Trump was sort of an existential moment, not just in the sense of, you know, broadly what it reflected about, you know, the state of our country. But also personally, like, you know, is this going to erase basically a decade worth of blood, sweat, and tears? And so that did prompt some really deep thinking about what I wanted to work on next. And so I was sort of primed and at a personal inflection point. Chris and Crystal Sacca were at a very different life stage. You know, I'd been 10 years in government and campaigns. They spent a decade building one of the most successful venture funds of all time. But they were in a similar inflection point, and we wanted to work on the same kinds of problems. And those two problems for us at the time were democracy and climate. Democracy was an urgent one, and in a lot of ways, a precondition to working on climate was solving the democratic threat that was posed not only by Donald Trump, but increasingly not to make this podcast about politics, but increasingly an undemocratic Republican Party. And so we got to work backing startups and entrepreneurs and nonprofits that worked like startups that were trying to expand people's ability to participate in elections and vote and run for office and run elections smarter than just, you know, lighting a pile of money on fire, running ads on television. Yeah. And so that was an urgent piece of work for us. But in the background, climate was always where we wanted to end up. And it was also an area where we had more catching up to do on the science, on building out the network, on going and visiting all the labs, reading the papers, following up with the authors, going to the conferences, and just figuring out, you know, how we could have impact in this space. But one thing I'll say that's important is when I joined Lowercase, Chris and Crystal had kind of retired from venture in a fairly public way at that point. That didn't change the fact that we had a number of funds that were outside of their active investment periods, but still active, and a large portfolio of companies, and we were still there to work with them and serve them, and that was a big part of our work at that time. But I think taking a public step back was a way to create a little bit of space, and it was an opportunity. It was time to go think about what it would look like for us to work on climate. Because in the beginning we had some hypotheses, but they were only hypotheses, and we hadn't committed ourselves to a path of investing, right? If in fact investing, which I should like point out, like wasn't the plan. It was a path, it was an option, but it wasn't the plan. And it took us a little while of being in this space of working with and among the entrepreneurs and the other people that were backing climate tech startups, but also just with the scientists and the labs and the nonprofits in this space to figure out where we could have what was the biggest lever was going to be for us.
No, it's amazing. I think, so 2019, you know, Chris Sacca and partner with you and Crystal, you re-entered the venture now with lower carbon capital. So I guess for those 2 years, the thesis sort of got a bit more, you know, hot. And I think the realization that time is running out fast led to sort of realization that, you know, technology is one of the biggest movers towards solving this problem.
Absolutely. So just to be clear, lower carbon capital started before 2019. Okay. Being quiet is not really in our DNA, but this is one area where we realized that we needed to be patient in sharing what we were doing with the rest of the world, because we needed to figure out if we were good at it first and if we could have an impact. You know, we didn't really want to jump out front and make a lot of noise and be a negative signal if it turned out like investing in this space wasn't the right way to make a difference. And I should also say, like, when we first got into it, I had, as I mentioned, sort of my brush with CleanTech 1.0. Chris worked on a lot of energy and specifically clean energy projects in his time at Google. And then as an investor, had seen a lot of companies cross his desk during that period. And so we were very aware of, you know, some of the biases about investing in clean tech. And I think those definitely affected our thinking in the early days. And, you know, just to call them out, I mean, there was this pervasive, and it's still something that I think people are getting over. And there's a lot of scar tissue, but kind of there are some ideas that, you know, companies needed $1 billion just to get out the gate invest in CapEx, and that the business models didn't pencil out unless policies changed, that had sort of carried over from the clean tech 1.0 days. Some of that was true for sure. Some of that also has like been solidified in sort of a mythology, but it's interesting. If you go back and talk to some of the folks that ran like the Kleiner Perkins clean tech funds, you know, they ended up making money in the end. It was just a really long J curve. And it took a little bit longer to get there. And what we discovered as we were getting into this line of work was, for a whole host of reasons, the timelines had changed and they had shortened. You know, starting with the fact that renewable energy is just really cheap today. And that's foundational to almost anything you want to do in climate tech, because at the end of the day, all these processes require electricity. And so getting it from carbon-free sources is important for making it actually climate tech. And the fact that, you know, it is cheaper today to set up a new solar array in many parts of the world, in most of the world, than it is to continue operating a natural gas or coal plant. That was foundational. And the same is happening now with onshore wind, and eventually we'll get there with offshore as well. So that's transformative. But then there were a whole other set of, kind of technology waves that were kind of crashing and self-reinforcing right around the same time. You know, we, as a result of 30 years of scaling up battery supply chains, which itself is critical for decarbonizing and storing, you know, decarbonizing our electricity systems and storing energy, that had driven a wave of innovation in electrochemistry for other applications outside of battery storage that are going to have transformative impacts in all kinds of material science, whether it's developing, you know, carbon-free steel or cement or hydrogen. Yeah. At the same time that you were seeing like major breakthroughs in bio, right? Like in 2018 was the year that the Nobel Prize was awarded for the discovery of CRISPR-Cas9, and since then we've seen just an explosion of new techniques for genetic sequencing and editing. Over the last year, we've had this massive scale up in mRNA that's made it much cheaper, and so, you know, that's obviously really critical for health and drug discovery, but it also has major implications for decarbonizing the chemicals industry, decarbonizing things like fertilizer, which is going to have a huge impact on agriculture. And so we see these big trends that are starting to really pick up steam. And that kind of coincides with, you know, these other, you know, mega trends in tech, just like the, you know, a generation of machine learning engineers that have, like, you know, really mastering new computational techniques, the advent of AI, which is great if you're building software, but it also is critical if you're trying to model plasma physics for your fusion reactor.
Absolutely.
You know, it's also, you know, it was really important that you had now a generation of entrepreneurs that were going to school and getting their PhDs, but never intended to spend 3 decades in academia. They were going with the intention of spinning out and building companies. It was also critical that you had major research universities all around the world that we're getting better at spinning those companies out and making the tech and IP transfer much more seamless. We still have a long way to go, but we're in such a radically different place than we were even 5 years ago. So as we started noticing these trends that were, like I said, in many cases, you know, self-reinforcing, and bringing down the cost of starting hard tech companies, of scaling them, of knocking down those initial kind of scientific and technical risks, you are getting to a place where relative to 10 or 15 years ago, with relatively small seed checks, you could see companies, you know, like much less than you would, you know, than a lot of software companies are raising today, like just knocking down some of the critical risks to building these really big and technical businesses. And that was really exciting to us. I mean, just to give one example, we're investors in a company in Sweden called Heart Aerospace. Mm-hmm. And when we met Anders, it would be deceptive to say that it was a team. It was really Anders. It was a one man show. And he had a plan to build a 19-seat electric airplane. And he, at the time, you know, when we were starting the diligence, every aerospace engineer out of Boeing and Airbus that we could talk to basically told us to run away. That an airplane that was running on batteries would never fly, literally. And yeah. It was going to be too heavy, and the densities weren't there. The energy densities weren't there for the batteries. But you know, maybe against our better judgment, we arrived at a different conclusion. And you know, I think in the same way that we weren't overly burdened with, you know, with the biases of clean tech 1.0, you know, we were coming to this with sort of fresh eyes. We found Anders' vision extremely compelling. And he's a great example of what you can do in just, you know, 2.5 years with a team that could probably still fit in the fuselage of one of those planes. And initially only a few million dollars raised, they built a full scale powertrain for an electric airplane. They were able to use a bunch of, you know, advanced software and modeling tools to basically prove out that this thing flies without having to build the plane itself. And then, you know, building out, because of a bunch of advanced manufacturing techniques, subscale models of the plane, and really getting a, you know, a high fidelity idea of what it was going to take to construct this. And that would blow people's minds that you could get so far down the road with so little. And so, you know, we were seeing this, of course, like, you know, now a lot of other people are figuring this out with respect to, you know, Anders and Heart Aerospace specifically, but with respect to this space in general as well. But we started seeing this in the investor updates that were rolling out every month, that companies were just tracking to these massively ambitious goals and even defying a lot of our expectations when we were getting into this space. And so that for us was sort of a tipping point of realizing, like, you know, we weren't the first ones into this space, but yeah, we realized that this small community of people that were working here, and you're one of them, that we were onto something, and it was really time to double down.
Nice, amazing. So I want to actually, you mentioned a few things, and I think that especially comes back to your early days in the White House. You know, Lower Carbon is a very unique platform, as you're very active, as I see, on two fronts. So obviously you're backing these technology companies, as you mentioned, like, but also you were, even in the early days when you said you were a bit more silent, you were funding nonprofit research to advance the science and policy, right? Could you expand a bit on the platform uniqueness to any other VC firm out there? Because I feel that this is really something that you principally understood and took that experience to now then implement in Lower Carbon. And I think that's a very crucial element, especially when you speak about, you know, taking great technologies out of universities and then, you know, investing in them and building these really businesses against all the odds, solve the most hardest problems out there.
Sure. So where I'll start is just by saying that anyone who works in the space, you know, knows this almost as a truism, but there are some things that we need to do to solve the climate crisis that just won't work as businesses, or it'll be a long time before they get there. And we need to advance that science anyway. And so as we, you know, as that was obvious to us, that's where we started. Even before we were investing, we were backing labs and research organizations that were doing work that we considered to be critical to the habitability of the planet over the course of the century, but that may not ever have a for-profit business model attached to it. I mean, for example, you know, we backed, you know, we're among the backers of a team at the University of Washington who are working on something called marine cloud brightening, which is literally the idea of making marine clouds whiter and brighter so that they reflect more sunlight and keep the Earth from, keep some of the sun's energy from hitting the surface of the Earth and can cool the planet actively that way. We're also backers of a number of research efforts to do the same thing at a stratospheric level. You know, how do we reflect a little bit of the sun's light so that we can actively cool the planet in places where it's just getting too hot for people to work outside or to live without air conditioning? And those are areas where we don't think that we hope there will never be a business model attached to it. And we hope we never have to deploy those kinds of technologies. But, if you just kind of look at the carbon budget and where things are headed, it appears that that's a distinct possibility. We started funding some of that work, and we consider that to be absolutely critical. Yeah, I mean, for us, it starts with the reality that, you know, we got into this work because we were looking for ways to address the climate crisis. As we discovered that some of the fastest and most scalable ways to do that were going to be in the context of for-profit businesses that could grow, have a gigaton scale impact, and in the process make mountains of, you know, piles of cash, we started to shift a lot of our energy into that space. But fundamentally, you know, we come to this with a desire to work on the fundamental problem, which is how do we keep this planet livable for the 7.8 and soon to be 10 billion humans that share it with us.
So you especially, I think you're in a way an advocate as well. I think Chris, especially on Twitter, and yourself as well, are pretty vocal about this problem in a very direct way. And I think generally, you know, you come as a very direct in approach how you communicate as a VC firm. So you stated that, you know, that healing the planet and making money aren't mutually exclusive, and you can be on, you know, camp one or just jump in on it. But how do you look at companies when it comes to measuring impact? Is there anything specific how you assess it? Or is just, I know on your website you had this sort of classification of slashing the new CO2, sucking up carbon, and buying more time. Is there any other way you kind of look at companies when you invest?
Look, I think what I'll start off by saying is that we look for companies that can have, you know, as they grow, a gigaton scale impact on the planet in terms of the carbon emissions that they can either avoid or remove. And not because, you know, gigatons is a bright line for us in our analysis, or we have some sort of threshold that says that if it's only going to be half a gigaton in 2032, we can't invest. Because ultimately, we're looking at very early stage companies. We're trying to predict, you know, their gigaton impact on the planet is like trying to predict, you know, when they're going to break $1 billion in revenue. Yeah. It's like we're looking for things that have that potential, but we're not.
Some people refer to now.
Exactly. I mean, the reason that that's part of our analysis on the front end is less because we have a firm threshold, and more because that to us is indicative of their ambition and the transformative impact that they can have on any given industry. So we do a lot of analysis before we invest, you know, like I said, but these are early teams, things are changing. And so we're having to continually update how we think of their carbon impact and how big it can be. So let me take a step back though and lay it out this way. When we think of the problem that has to get solved, there's too much CO2 in the atmosphere. And so we see basically three paths. The first is reducing emissions from new and really hard to decarbonize sources of CO2. So here we're talking about some of the dirtiest industries in the world: agriculture, heavy duty transportation, protein, chemicals industry, and some of the, you know, the electricity sectors, the places that generate a lot of emissions today. That's going to be the bulk of our focus. The second category for us is removing CO2 that's already in the atmosphere and putting it back in the ground. I mean, this isn't new to you, but even if we turned off all emissions overnight, there's so much CO2 in the atmosphere, and it has a lifetime of between 100 and 1,000 years that we've already committed ourselves to pretty terrible working conditions for most of the people on this planet. And so we have to figure out a way to pull some of that CO2 out of the sky and put it back in the ground or turn it into some useful chemicals and chemical precursors. And then, as I alluded to when I was talking about the kind of science that we back, we have to look for ways to buy time and add some runway for the people and the ecosystems that are on the front lines of the climate crisis. For us, a lot of that is going to be in the form of basic science research and grants. But we're also looking for business models that are fundamentally aligned with helping people adapt.
So I want to come back more on the personal side, Clint. So why does getting to net zero or net negative matter for you on a personal level?
That's an interesting question. I mean, look, fundamentally, the world doesn't need another accounting app. And so when we think about where we want to spend our time, why we came to climate, it's because this is, you know, there are other important issues to work on. This isn't the only one, but for us, it's at the very top of the stack. You know, sometimes you hear people give an answer, which is that, oh, well, I have kids and I want to leave a better future for them. Yeah. That's important. Like, I have two daughters and undoubtedly that's a big part of my calculus, but I don't like to dwell on that too much. And I think it's actually kind of bullshit, because if you can't get fired up about about this type of work on behalf of the 7.8 billion other humans, then you're not doing it right. I think fundamentally, this is a crisis that's affecting hundreds of millions, if not billions of people directly today. And it's only getting worse. And so it's personal, because I'm a human being and because, you know, I'm an inhabitant of planet Earth. And, you know, it's like, it's an affront on all of us. And so, you know, it's hard to think at the full landscape of things we could be working on and pick something that's more urgent or more personal.
So what, in your opinion, is the most challenging part of that journey? You know, whether net to net zero or net negative?
Undoubtedly, it's the fact that we're running out of time. Like, we will get there, right? Yeah. We're investing in technology that is cleaner, better, faster, cheaper than the 100-year-old industrial systems that they're replacing, right? Fundamentally, like, those are going to get cheaper. They're going to scale faster, and they're going to win out against those incumbents, not because of anyone is being guilt and shamed into it, but just because the technology itself is better and the products are going to be superior. The question is whether we can do that on a time scale that is impactful for climate change. And that is the biggest challenge that we have. It's why we need a lot more capital flowing into these opportunities, right? Fundamentally, like, we're in this work because, you know, we think we're going to make a lot of money doing it. And we want to show other people that they can too. And so the top priority is to bring more capital into the space and to bring more talent as a result. Because if every creative and ambitious person that you know isn't working on this problem in one way or another 10 years from now, we're never going to get there.
No, totally agree with you. Totally in the same line. So you work with Chris. He's perceived as one of the superstars in the VC game. Well, you also build already a career in VC and working on something that you're very passionate about. What do you think makes a great VC investor, in your opinion?
I mean, it's a tricky one. And yet also the answer is really obvious. The answer is patience. You know, it's funny. Yeah. When I started at Lowercase, I was coming into a few portfolios that were all outside of the active investment period and sort of year five and beyond. And that was actually incredible training ground for anyone who wants to get into venture. Like, there were no new investments getting made. It was managing those portfolios. And it's incredibly important, I think, from a mental training standpoint, to see schedules of investment where, you know, you had companies that in year three and four were high flyers and had multi-$100 billion valuations, and by year six were liquidating because, you know, the trend hadn't panned out something else hadn't worked. That's how I learned this industry. That's how I learned this work. And it reinforced for me that, like, you know, the markups from month to month and year to year are nice and they can give you a sense of where things are headed. But ultimately, you are measured by how things turn out over the lifetime of your fund. And for us, that's, you know, that's about 10 years. And so it really reinforced this idea, as I talked about, you know, from my experience in government, that you just need to be incredibly patient.
So what advice do you have for our audience? We have VC investors, innovators, and LPs. Is there some message that you want to transmit?
Yeah, I mean, and that's just that there's no trade-off anymore between making money and working on stuff that matters. And so choose how you spend your time carefully.
Nice. I like that. You know, you're quite busy, as I know. You know, you guys are one of the most active investors in the space, you know, and with, again, investing, you're doing a lot of things on policy. How do you stay sharp? You know, what do? You read books, podcasts, you write, you tweet. What inspires you? Anything you want to share?
You know, it's like drinking from a fire hose. There's, you know, so many different journals that we look at, and you know, people in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. that we're talking to, and trying to stay on top of all the developments. If I had to point people to one place, I mean, you know, one of my kind of core resources is Carbon Brief, is really incredible, kind of helping understand the intersection of new science research and policy. I also am a weekly listener of My Climate Journey, which I think is also a great way if you're looking to, you know, just begin to understand the rudiments of climate tech and the businesses that are getting built here, there's probably no better place to start.
Amazing. Thanks a lot, Clay, for spending the time. I think you guys are doing an amazing job and really leading by example. So really, really thanks for sharing this with the community.
Cool. Hey, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.